through his discussion.
Good morning. Welcome to the March 27th meeting of the House Economic Development and Trade Committee. We have a number of public hearings and one public hearing and potential work session today. So let's get started. We're going to begin with a public hearing. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2736 related to smoke shops and invite Mr. Adam Crawford to give us a brief description, and then we'll start calling forward Representative Post to describe it and other witnesses who signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2736 allows a smoke shop certified by the Oregon Health Authority to allow on-premise consumption of alcoholic beverages.
Great. Welcome, Representative Post.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Bill Post, representing House District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. Quick history lesson, In 2007, the Oregon Legislature passed the Indoor Clean Air Act. Later in 2011, the legislature passed a bill which allowed for certain smoke shops to be grandfathered in, allowing smoking in those shops if they met the criteria that was laid out in that bill. As part of the negotiating of those definitions that substantially changed the cigar shop industry with some unfortunate and, I believe, unintended consequences, one of them being that employees were now no longer able to eat their lunch at work or have a bottle of water on premises. So when I got elected in 2014, I made that one of my priorities. In 2015, the only bill I've ever passed so far, HB 2969, which passed 89-1, and because he's gone, I can now throw him under the bus. Representative Widener was the no, just because he said he needed a no vote that day. I'll never forgive him for that. We don't speak. Anyway, it passed 89-1. It struck the unintended language, I think, the unintended consequences of that language, and allowed food and non-alcoholic beverages to be consumed on premise of certified cigar shops. And I keep saying certified because that's the key to this, is there is a certification process that these cigar shops must go through every 5 years. So I'm before you here today because there's another change that I think would be incredibly helpful to an industry here in Oregon that we in this committee have been talking about a lot, and I think that we're all very interested in, and that's the growing wine and craft beverage and craft distillery industry. So this bill before you, HB 2736, would bring back the success of earlier days when we paired complementary industries and helping them help each other prosper. Certified cigar shops have a certain kind of clientele, those who are folks that are willing to pay a little more for something like a cigar. Cigars are a little more expensive, premium cigars. And this bill would allow our own Oregon wineries to offer their wares and a tasting to appreciative audiences who would then purchase bottles of those wines from that winery at these events. Now, this bill does not allow the certified cigar shops to sell alcoholic drinks. They do not want to sell drinks. They don't want to provide drinks. They don't want to become an alcohol sales point. They simply want to offer their venue as a place where we can promote Oregon beverage talents. It would also add the benefit of allowing the clientele of a certified cigar shop to BYOB, bring your own beverage, as many cigar users like to enjoy a select alcoholic beverage with their cigar. So the minor change that I'm looking to achieve is to take the portion of ORS 433.847 from what it says now. Does not sell or offer food or beverages, does not sell, offer, or allow on-premise consumption of alcoholic beverages. I want it now to read, and which I want to pause for a moment. We did not get the amendment this morning. I'd like to thank Representative Lewis pointed out a mistake that we had made in the original language. So what you see before you, if you're looking at the bill, is not what I want it to say. There's a change, a couple of words. What I want it to read, if you look at that, I think it's section D or subsection D, I wanted to read, does not sell or offer food or beverages and does not sell alcoholic beverages. So taking the offer or offer out. And one of the things I want to be very clear on is legislative intent. Alcoholic beverages. I don't know about you. I spent a little bit of time last night on Wikipedia because nobody uses dictionaries anymore. I use dictionaries, but nobody else uses dictionaries anymore. And an alcoholic beverage is a drink. Something's in a glass that you drink out of. We're not looking to sell drinks because some of these cigar shops actually sell bottles of wine and other wine-related industries, so they don't want to sell that wine as a drink. They just want to sell their wine. So I want to make sure we understand what a beverage is. As far as I'm concerned, what the legislative intent is, we want to have a place that provides beverages by other organizations, like a winery. So I believe we can add a real boon to the wine, craft beer, and craft distillery industry, as well as tourism, and as well as building the cigar shop industry, which is interesting. You'll find on OLIS a sheet of paper or a PDF. What's left in Oregon of the certified smoke shops and cigar bars? And I'm not going to read them off, but there are 24 smoke shops left in Oregon, and there are 10 cigar bars. One thing, just so you know, this is fascinating. The way the law was written, it was finally formalized in 2011, the cigar bars are going to go away, and they will not come back. The cigar bars were grandfathered in. The owner that owns them, if he, she dies, that's the end of the cigar bar. So at some point, those 10 are going to be 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. So there won't be any more cigar bars. The cigar shops, if they meet certain criteria, they can transfer that ownership and that certification. That would be the cigar shops, but not the cigar bars. So it's an industry that's already been battered, and I think that we, as this Committee of Economic Development and Trade, would like to see it grow. So with that, I would say there is a couple of other things on OLIS. I think you'll find something from the craft or from the Brewers Guild, I believe it is, the Oregon Brewers Guild. Mm-hmm. The brewery associations would like to get involved in this. They're very excited about this. So I think that's everything I have, and would love to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Post? So I have a question then. Mm-hmm. Rep Post, you have an amendment in process, and it just didn't happen to get posted or finished in time for this hearing.
Exactly. Okay. Chair Leininger, yeah, I was told it would get to me over the weekend and I could get it to our analysts, but it did not get here in time.
Okay. Well, and Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Leininger. This is an intriguing idea, but I just have a question about people are able to bring in their own alcoholic beverages. So if I wanted to bring in some beer to have with my cigar, I could do that?
Excuse me, Chair Leininger and Vice Chair Representative Marsh. Yes, that would be the BYOB portion of this.
So,
please. Yeah.
So my question then is, in place public places that serve alcohol, the server is required to be licensed by the OLCC and to manage the alcohol consumption of the customer. How would you manage that in this case?
Chair Leininger and Representative Marsh, that's a great question. I don't know. We've never thought that through. So it's a good question. The greater thing that we're trying to do here is, prior to 2007, in cigar shops, we would have events where Camacho Cigar Company would come in with their cigars, and Willamette Valley Vineyards would come in with their wine, and they would give out samples. The cigar guy would, so everybody did well, and it was one of those things where there was a lot of wine sold, and there were a lot of cigars sold. So that's kind of where I'm trying to go with this.
May I ask?
Yes, please.
So I can see if you had a brewery or a winery sampling, then clearly the person who's sampling is in charge of monitoring. But maybe in the amendment process, we could think through that question of supervision of intake, because I think that would be a critical question. If we just allowed BYOB.
Good point.
Other questions? So I actually have another question. I'm really interested in the idea of offering opportunities for our craft beverage sector to expand their market share, get more attention, get more customers. So I think this is an interesting idea. Have you talked to OLCC about how the BYOB, or offering but not selling served drinks, would, whether they're neutral on that, open to that, or is that conversation that would be forthcoming?
Chair Langer, that would be a good conversation. What I did have a conversation with OLCC on, I had another bill that was sort of an accompaniment to this bill. It was 2735, I think it was. And that was what I wanted to do, and it would take care of what Vice Chair Marsh had to say, is I wanted to, and I still would like to see this done, shift. So OHA is responsible for cigar shops. OLCC is responsible for marijuana, alcohol, all the other so-called sins. I would like to see all of them under one roof. So one of the things that I wanted to do was transfer the certification of smoke shops from OHA to OLCC and then just get them out of that business. And I think they would like to get out of that business, and I think OLCC wouldn't mind taking that on. What I ran into a roadblock was the OHA, the money that OHA uses to certify these shops every 5 years, which it is every 5 years, comes out of a certain settlement fund that they're perhaps not willing to give up to OLCC. So, and OLCC is saying, well, where are we going to get the fees? And where are we going to, how are we going to pay for this? So I ran into a roadblock there. I'm not done. I'm still working on that. And I think that would clear up a lot of this stuff if I could get that done at the same time, if that makes sense.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. And you'll have a chance after we hear public comment from other folks. We'll give you a chance to offer follow-up remarks from the dais if you're interested.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. All right. So now I'm going to call forward a couple of different witnesses. Oh, okay. So let's call forward, please, Oregon Health Authority, Karen Girard, Christopher Friend from ACS CAN, and Courtney Dresser from OMA, and then on deck we'll have Bill Cross from Willamette Valley Vineyards, please. Welcome. Go ahead and in any order, just state your name for the record before you start.
Good morning, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. I'm Karen Girard. I'm the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Manager at the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm here today to provide information about House Bill 2736 concerning the allowance of on-premises consumption of alcohol beverages at smoke shops certified by the Oregon Health Authority. Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act protects nearly every Oregon employee from the health risks of secondhand smoke by prohibiting smoking in most public places and workplaces. There are a few exceptions that continue to expose Oregonians to secondhand smoke, and those exceptions include cigar bars and smoke shops. House Bill 2736 would amend the Indoor Clean Air Act to allow for the consumption of alcoholic beverages at smoke shops certified by the Oregon Health Authority. Currently, the Oregon Health Authority has certified 24 smoke shops, and according to statute, one of the requirements for being a certified smoke shop is that the business, quote, allows smoking of tobacco product samples only for the purpose of making retail purchase decisions. Thus, smoke shops allow the customer to sample tobacco to determine what tobacco product they would like to purchase, which is unrelated to the consumption of alcohol. Currently, it is only legal to smoke cigars only and consume alcohol in the same premises in 10 cigar bars, which were grandfathered in when the Indoor Clean Air Act passed in 2007. Allowing consumption of alcoholic beverages in smoke shops expands the places where people can smoke tobacco and drink alcohol in the same commercial establishment. The Indoor Clean Air Act specifically prohibited smoking in bars, with the sole exemption being the existing cigar bars, and erodes social norms that have been changed by the Indoor Clean Air Act legislation all over the country. Exposure to secondhand smoke continues to affect Oregonians. In 2015, an estimated 500,000 Oregonians reported that they are exposed to secondhand smoke. In Oregon, more than 750,000 people use tobacco, including more than 500,000 who smoke cigarettes. Administering and enforcing Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act contributes to the Public Health Division's mission of promoting health and preventing the leading cause of death, disease, and injury. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think we'll have the whole panel present, and then we'll open it up to questions. Welcome.
Great. Good morning. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Christopher Friend. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, or ACS-CAN. ACS-CAN is the advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society, and our hundreds of members across the state are dedicated to ending cancer as a major health illness through evidence-based policy solutions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning in strong opposition to HB 2736. As a strong proponent for a smoke-free Oregon, ACS-CAN was a leader, among other organizations, in ensuring the passage of Oregon's Clean Indoor Air Act. This measure ensures that Oregonians don't have to choose between a paycheck and their own health. The act also protects traditionally low-wage workers and their families from cancer-causing particles present in first- and second-hand smoke. And we strongly encourage the committee to reject this measure, as it would weaken the Clean Indoor Air Act. As a compromise, ACS-CAN and other public health partners in tobacco control conceded the grandfathering of existing smoke shops when the law took effect. We believe that this would be a fair trade-off, allowing the few existing smoking lounges to remain statewide, protecting those who work in the hospitality industry. ACS-CAN strongly opposes any attempt to revise the Clean Indoor Air Act without intentions of strengthening the provision of the legislation. In the tobacco prevention arena, we talk about the three-legged stool of prevention. Strong tobacco prevention efforts include a significant and regular increase to tobacco tax, a comprehensive tobacco prevention program, an education program, and finally, the most important for us, is smoke-free workplaces and public places. House Bill 2736 isn't a one-off allowance of simply allowing BYOB. ACS-CAN sees this bill as a larger threat to the Clean Indoor Air Act and the health of Oregonians. If passed, it would create a precedent for allowing tobacco use in bars and other public places. ACS-CAN also opposes 2736 because there is strong evidence. As a strong evidence-based organization, research shows there's a strong mutual craving between nicotine products and alcohol. According to the NIH report released in 2007, studies that show consuming tobacco and alcohol together can augment the pleasure for users' experience from one drug to another. As a statewide organization dedicated to preventing Oregonians from getting cancer, we strongly urge you to oppose this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee this morning, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Dresser.
Thank you very much, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. Thank you, Representative Langinger, and the rest of the committee for having us today. I think prior to my work at the OMA, I served in the position that Christopher now has at the American Cancer Society and was for 5 years working very hard on the law that we're discussing right now, and was very much involved in the negotiations and the work that was done between the legislative body and the stakeholders on the exemptions that we do have to the Clean Indoor Act. And I very much appreciate Representative Post the economic end of this bill and why we're looking at it in this committee. But I do want to remind the committee about why we had the bill in the first place and why we have the law in the first place, and the drama and the issue about secondhand smoke in workplaces. And the whole point of the bill was to get as many employees as possible to work in an environment that did not have secondhand smoke in it, and to have as clean of an environment as possible for people who go to work every day. So my concern right now with this legislation is that, as again, as simple as it is and as fine-tuned and narrowed as it is, that it is a step, even if it's a small baby step, a step in the wrong direction. And we want to continue to keep employees as healthy as possible and employment places as healthy as possible. So at this time, we are opposed to this type of legislation.
Thanks very much. Does anybody have any questions for the panel? Looks like we don't have any questions for the panel. Thank you so much for being here. Now I'll invite Bill Cross forward. And if anyone else is interested in testifying on this bill, let me know. But that's our last witness signed up for today on this bill. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Willamette Valley Vineyards, and we do support a House Bill 2736. I think Representative Post indicated the reasons why the wineries, breweries, distilleries would be interested in this opportunity. As it happens, before the law is passed, Willamette Valley Vineyards did some tastings with several cigar shops, and it's a market, I mean, a clientele that's a good market for wines, distilled spirits, higher-end microbrews, that type of thing. So it would be one more opportunity, especially for the smaller wineries that don't have the distribution advantages that the large wineries do because of the production capacity. And for a lot of small wineries, their primary opportunity to sell wines is in their tasting rooms. So when they do get special events or tastings at stores or something like this, it's a great opportunity for them to get their name out and to sell some product. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Brockman.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you. Can you tell me the, and forgive me for my lack of knowledge, but can you tell me the difference between the law that allows wine tasting at your wineries? Of course, distilleries have a similar, are they incorporated in the same law? And they have a shop that allows for tastings at their distilleries, and of course it's different than a tavern license, or I forget the levels, or the full on-premise sales.
Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, there are a number of statutes that regulate wineries versus breweries versus distilleries, that regulate in-store tastings, like at grocery stores, special events. OLCC has different rules than implementing those statutes. OLCC, as it happens, has what they call an interested parties group of industry representatives from those categories, along with the beer and wine distributors and others, to look at opportunities within the statutes to, streamline the rules when possible, that type of thing. But clearly, the tastings that Willamette Valley Vineyards does in their tasting room is totally it's guided by statutes that are totally separate from what this would amend.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Cross? All right. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Representative Post, would you like to add some thoughts in to follow on to the comment that we've heard today?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would. I want to point out that back in 2015 when through the Business and Labor Committee and then over in the Senate side, I actually don't remember what committee it was there, HB 2969, which took out the food or drink prohibition, there was no opposition to that at that time. And it was, part of it was, in essence, a BYOB, bring your own coffee, bring your own water, bring your own Coca-Cola, whatever. And there was no opposition at that time, so I literally just assumed I was making the next step here. And so I understand the fear and the concern about going forward with this, but I think we're looking at a very unique situation with these cigar shops. It's not a bar, and we don't want it to be a bar. We want it to be a place where people can sample products from other manufacturers. But yes, there is a BYOB thing that I do think we need to look further into. Really, the intention is to blend two communities together and perhaps have both of them prosper. I don't want to see these 24 smoke shops go away. I want to see them expand and there be more of them. So that's kind of the intention behind this.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I'll look forward to hearing back from you as we talk about next steps and when your amendment comes through and we can think about what's possible for the session. But I think it's an intriguing idea. We've talked about that. Okay, thanks a lot. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2736, and we're going to open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3116, which allows producers to sell candled eggs designated as ungraded. So here we have Representative Marsh is coming down to introduce her bill. And first, Mr. Crawford, if you'd like to describe it, that'd be helpful.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3116 allows sale of candled eggs as ungraded if the producer sells directly to customers by consignment or at a location used for farm direct marketing. It specifies labeling and information requirements for ungraded eggs, exempts sale of ungraded eggs from egg handler fee, allows sale of shell eggs at location used for farm direct marketing if the producer is a seller or seller is a licensed as an egg handler.
Representative Marsh, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Leininger, members of the committee. House Bill 3116 is a little tiny piece of economic development, but one that will be greatly welcomed by customers and vendors at the farmers markets and fresh farm stands that sit across the state. If you have ever purchased eggs at one of those locations, you know that one of the great pleasures of that process is opening the carton to see a variety of often colors and sizes and even shapes of those eggs. However, a recent ruling by the Department of Justice to the Department of Agriculture suggests that our statutes do not allow eggs in these settings to be sold as ungraded. Now, this is a problem for farmers who are producing a modest number of eggs and often wrangling a great variety of chickens with different egg-laying capabilities. It adds unnecessary complexity to the process, and I would even argue that it's really not what in the to the benefit of consumers who are not looking for standardization in the products that they buy from the farmers market. HB 3116 clarifies that farm direct eggs may be sold as ungraded. The carton must be clearly labeled as such, along with other information that's already required to be on the packaging. So that's it, a little tiny bill, good step forward for chickens across the state. And we have a number of experts here who can talk to us more about that.
Any comments for Representative Marsh, Rep. Post?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clem and I were just, ever since I stared at this bill, candled egg means different colored eggs? Is that what that means?
I'm going to let the egg expert speak to that. The eggs will still have to be candled, basically, to check the level of development of the egg, make sure it isn't turning into a chicken, as I understand it. But they won't have to be graded, which means that they are sorted specifically to match in terms of the shell quality and beyond that. I'm going to let the egg expert speak to it.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Representative. Can ungraded eggs be consumed in cigar shops?
Only if they're pickled. Your
own
beer.
Just checking. Thank you.
Okay, Rep. Rocksmith. I'm sorry, Representative Marsh. You got us all really engaged.
No, this is such a great bill.
More of a comment than a question. Just appreciate the bill. I can't tell you how many folks just in my district raise chickens and sell them all over the place at various farmers markets and they bring them into their office and give them, sell them away. And you see little signs that say, carton of eggs, $2 a carton, or, $3 a carton. It's just, and there's nothing better than those fresh farm stand.
I would agree. It's an egg like none that you've tasted when you get them from the farmer's market.
When I had a restaurant, we used to give them the lettuce and all of the clippings, and we would get eggs in return.
Interesting. So I'd just like to compliment you as a first-year legislator on choosing wisely to bring a bill that seems like a good idea that no one opposes, that unites us across party lines. I think in addition to the value of the bill, which we'll hear more about, I think this is a great indication of your good judgment as a freshman legislator. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
All right. Now we'll call forward Rebecca Landis, Lynn Miller, and Ivan Molesky. Welcome, you can speak in any order, please. However, begin by stating your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Rebecca Landis, and I'm here representing the Corvallis Albany Farmers Markets, and I'm the policy advisor to the Oregon Farmers Markets Association. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify for this bill, and I'm specifically supporting the Dash 2 amendments. I don't know if you have those in front of you, but that's what I'm supporting. And I want to thank our bill sponsor and also Representative Clem, who helped birth the Farm Direct Law in 2011. That is sort of the foundation of what we're talking about here. So with the amendments, we have three things that we're trying to accomplish with this bill. We want to create a clear exemption for ungraded eggs in Farm Direct and consignment settings. I'll explain that more later. For Farm Direct marketers, we want to allow the use of an ungraded labeling scheme for Farm Direct marketers, even if they also sell graded eggs to stores under an egg handler license. And this is apart from ungraded eggs. We'd like to clarify the circumstances for selling any eggs, not just ungraded, in a consignment situation under the Farm Direct Law. Either the producer or the farmer who sells the eggs on behalf of the producer would have to maintain an egg handler license. And that's how the Dash, how it comes out under the Dash 2. So a little background. I was working with both Extension and ODA Food Safety on an educational paper for Farm Direct egg producers. And at that time, we were pretty far through. I'd say we were, 80 or 90% through. And we realized that ODA did not believe that ungraded eggs were legal in Oregon. This was a bit of a surprise. Ungraded eggs are widely sold at farmers markets, farm stands, and other Farm Direct venues. It did not come up within a year of a work group on the Farm Direct bill where we were, you know the tradition, you put us in a room and we work it out kind of thing. So, and I think I may have realized that I'd be sitting here with sort of figurative egg on my face before you at some point. But we have good lines of communication now with the Oregon Department of Agriculture, so that makes it possible to be here today. I did some legal research. ODA checked with its DOJ counsel. We determined, among a lot of other things, that we had Oregon administrative rules that mention ungraded eggs that are odds, of course. Now, those are at odds with our statutes and as interpreted by DOJ. And the good thing is ODA agrees that it would be fine to legalize ungraded eggs if candling is required. And I'm not maybe an expert, but candling is exposing an egg to light and looking for defects of various kinds. I think cracks, the smallest ones are called checks, are probably the most important thing that you're looking for in candling. Our goal is to pass this bill and then move back to the education of farmers about what the requirements are to sell eggs in Oregon in the Farm Direct context. So a little legal background. ATRA is a USDA contractor that has a very good paper on egg practice, and they say in that paper that egg grading is not required by federal law and that most states do allow ungraded eggs. So the grading and quality assessment are actually kind of a 20th century phenomenon. And in one history, I found that the first state to do this, New York producers, they were really hoping to generate consumer demand for higher quality and a higher price. So it wasn't really all about safety, but quality certainly includes safety. While these laws no doubt retain relevance in the larger U.S. food system, the 21st century regulators at USDA and FDA really found it necessary early this century to add temperature controls from the point that you wash the eggs to the point of sale. These newer regulations have at least as much role, if not more, in quality and safety than the grading system does. So the way you wash eggs is actually very important to whether they're safe or not. So grading is also kind of a process that is designed for big lots of eggs. Individual eggs are assessed for quality standards. I think I'm going to skip over the details of that, but we're talking about things like
keeping it pretty high level.
Yeah, we need to move on from that. I'm just going to underline something Representative Marsh already said, that ungraded eggs will remain subject to a lot of other laws, federal and state consumer laws, including those federal temperature regulations, the requirement to have the consumer safety requirement on each carton, the Farm Direct disclaimer, NX would still be dated. And I want to add, there was one concern raised, and I think we can probably do take care of that by stating clearly in the record what we think the duties of producers are. There's already a law that says that when you reuse a carton for any purpose, whether it's ungraded or not, that you have to obliterate the trademarks of the prior owner of that carton, because it's completely inappropriate to be passing off your eggs as someone else's. The concern would be, would someone leave a grade marking on a carton that is now ungraded? This bill will have labeling requirements for ungraded, but would there also be something else there? So what I would say to all producers that I work with, and what we'll say in this educational paper, is that anything that is not true on that carton needs to be obliterated. And I would probably think that generic labeling laws in other parts of ODA law would cover this. You don't want to make any untrue claim in marketing an agricultural product, or for that matter another product. And so I think that current law will probably cover that, but I think it's a valid concern that we want to make sure that people don't misrepresent their product. So I also have some research about how long it takes for eggs to degrade in quality, but the bottom line of what's in my testimony is that even if you badly handled your eggs, it would take a whole month for them to go to degrade down to a level of B grade eggs, and the USDA still thinks that there's something decent that you can do with B grade eggs. They are ideal for cake mixes and omelets, according to the USDA.
You know, I think if you could wrap up
okay.
the next minute.
All right,
so
we have a good safety track record in Oregon. There's no body of complaints. ODA would not be agreeing to this bill if there were. These eggs sell well. They don't come to more than one market generally. Eggs at market generally go home with someone. Other than the producer, and I've been buying them for 25 years, and I've never seen a bad egg. There are customers want these eggs. They're unless they're doing some precise baking, the size differences are not considered a minus. We have kind of an issue with we have a lot of turkey, duck, and not a lot of turkey. We have a lot of duck eggs in the market, and we're beginning to see goose and turkey and other eggs, and the quality standards and grading system doesn't work well for those things. And so in summary, these eggs, ungraded eggs, serve a function for small farms, even those that are grading most of their eggs, where they, and I think Lynn can address what that function is in the marketplace.
Excellent.
And that's enough for me.
Wonderful, thanks. And I will just note, as you're thinking about I really appreciate your being here today. As we're thinking about regulations that are appropriately applicable to this product, I'll note that the amendment and, in general, the things that we consider in the committee, to the extent that it won't add cost in terms of the administration of the program, particularly in this tough fiscal environment, it's great to, if we can not require things that cost extra money, if they have only a de minimis value, that's a great place to be. So I think that the dash 2 does not appear to add burden, but just, you know, in all the matters that we consider in the committee, we're trying hard to focus on not adding extra layers of cost when we can avoid it. So that for framework. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Miller.
My name's Lynn Miller. I am a small producer, sells at farmers markets. I'm also a president of an indoor winter market that I administer, and I'm also vice president of the Benton County chapter of the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Great.
And one of my reasonings behind being involved in Farm Bureau is that we like to facilitate farmers of all sizes being able to be in business and not have undue regulation or pressures put on them. As a small producer, it's my mother and I, two women farming. This would add, having to grade each and every egg and do this when, as Rebecca said, eggs seldom go to more than one market. If they do, never more than two. It would add a great deal of time spent processing eggs, which would either lead to an increase in price or enough bother that we would just quit. We would drop that product. And in practice, we have been doing everything that this amendment provides for 5 years now, and not had a single complaint on our eggs. And so I feel that this is just closing a gap between the perceived intent of the law and the actual real-world practice. And so for those reasons, I'm in favor of this.
Great. Wonderful. So, Mr. Molesky, let's have you go, and then if anyone has questions, we'll jump in.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky with Friends of Family Farmers. Thanks for having us here today. We're in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3116. I must say, with respect to Representative Post, this is a more pleasant topic to talk about at 8 in the morning, scrambled eggs, hard-boiled eggs, than pairing liquor with cigars. But that all said, that's just my opinion. But the reason why we're in support of this bill, we work with farmers across the state, many of whom engage in farm direct sales, farmers markets, CSAs, farm stands. And you may not know, and I'll keep my testimony short, but farm direct agriculture, it really is an important part of Oregon's agricultural economy, and it provides income for thousands of small and mid-sized farms. According to USDA Census of Agriculture, Oregon is now in the top 10 states nationally for total value in farm direct sales. We do about $44 million per year in farm direct as of 2012. We rank sixth in the nation in the number of farms that sell farm direct, with over 6,000 operations doing so. So this sort of component, the farm direct eggs, is part of that. And recognizing the importance of this farm direct sector, the legislature in 2011 did pass the farm direct law, which clarified rules around labeling and certifications and licensing. And so this bill really is just follows in that vein. It's intended to allow for farm direct sale of ungraded eggs and the labeling as such, which is currently a widely undertaken practice across Oregon. But it turns out that the law and the rules are inconsistent. And so that's really what this bill does, is makes the law consistent with current practice and the existing rules in the state. So we urge your support. It's a good bill. It should pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't want to mention the name of the place just in case they're not complying completely, but I have a wonderful guy down the road from me that we buy our eggs from. Now, he puts them in old used Safeway cartons or containers. Is that okay? Or is that going to need to be addressed through this bill? Maybe Representative Marsh or whomever, but you know what I mean? He just uses old egg cartons and he puts these eggs in.
We'll go to Representative Marsh.
Okay. Sure. The bill requires that the cartons be clearly noted as ungraded. There are other packaging requirements as well, and as some of the panelists spoke to, the practice is that all indications of the previous use should be obliterated on the carton, so that it's and with that done, then it's appropriate to reuse the carton.
So as a follow-up,
yes, please.
So I don't want to get him in trouble. So if this were to pass, he's going to need to start doing that, or is that part of the dash?
That's really all part of current practice. Is that packaging clearly old packaging should clearly be marked. To indicate that the product that's currently in using the package is a different product.
Okay. All
right. Just take your marker, mark it all out.
Sure.
Representative Klim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rebecca, you may have already explained this once, and my brain just wasn't wrapping around. But
it's 8 in the morning.
Why is it we use the word candled?
Well, it's just one of those, Madam Chair, Representative Klein. It's one of those sort of historic terms. Candling does refer to a light source, but it no longer refers to a flame because we have electric candling devices. And so it's a way of, you shine a light behind the egg and you're able to see the interior of the egg and see some defects that you might not see with the naked eye.
Yes, please.
And the reason we're using the word candled in the statute is because some of this is not referring to candled. It's referring to ungraded eggs. But in this one section, it talks about candled using the designation ungraded. I want to make sure we're not limiting ourselves beyond what we want to, because candling looks like it's more of a way to see the development, but not inherently part of safety or anything else. It's from my internet research on candling, anyway.
Madam Chair, Representative Klim, candling is part of the grading process that historically has been done to eggs under Oregon law and the laws of many other states, I'm sure, as well. in this context, what we're doing is we're adding candling as a requirement to use of the newly authorized ungraded label, because the ODA felt that that's a condition of the ODA's support and comfort with this bill, is adding the candling process to, well, not adding it, but ensuring that the candling process is part of what it takes to earn the right or responsibility to use this newly codified ungraded label. And it's something that that farmers will know to some degree about, but it's also something that the Extension Service and ODA's Food Safety Division and I will make sure is well explained to farmers in this new paper that we're working on.
Excellent. Do you have any more thoughts on that?
Just one
please,
more thought.
Yeah.
Do you know, do the dash twos define candling, or does something define candling? Because I don't see any other place in the bill where it's defined.
Madam Chair, Representative Clem, I believe that candling is probably defined in the Oregon Administrative Rules. I can't cite that for you right now, but I'm suspecting all the detail in our egg law is in the OARs rather than the ORS. And I will say, you know, it's a quaint sort of sounding word, and there are a lot of quaint, strange words in both our ORS and our OAR in the egg law, and I have this desire to modernize all that, but I know that that's not how legislation should be done. We're going to just address the things that we're here to address, and I'm going to stay away from making too many comments on archaic language.
All right.
So many wise comments being offered during this public hearing and work session. Rep. Post, did you have a follow-up, or were you just stretching?
Well, I was kind of stretching, but I thank you. I do a little bit. And this was more, again, for Representative Marsh. Just because this conversation has led to it, it's better. Man, normally less is best, but it's best to have more. Really define it. I'm playing off what he just said. As one who has found out the difference between legislative intent and the rulemaking, what you intend for this bill to say, and what gets written in the rules is not always the same thing. So doggedly pursue this. Make sure you cross every T and dot every I. I've learned the hard way.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so where I think we are, thank you three very much, and you're welcome to go have a seat again or leave or whatever you want to do. We sure appreciate you coming in. I think the next step, since the Dash 2 is something that is new to us as of this meeting, we aren't going to have a work session on the bill today. We were thinking that we would have a work session on it, but this gives us some time for Representative Marsh and Mr. Crawford to make sure that we understand what candling means, either by rule or elsewhere in the legislation. And then we still need the fiscal impact statement and actually have us get the Dash 2 amendment, which hadn't yet gotten to OLIS or the committee. So. Mr. Crawford.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I apologize. In fact, Representative Marsh's office had sent me the Dash 2 on the 17th of March. Unfortunately, it was buried in my inbox. So apologies to Representative Marsh and her office. We've got that in for a fiscal and revenue request as of now, and the Dash 2s are currently up on OLIS.
Oh, perfect. Well, there you go. So hopefully Wednesday, if not Wednesday, maybe Monday, we can work this bill. But we're on track. Great bill. Thanks very much. And with that, we will close the hearing and possible work session on House Bill 3116 and open. We have two more public hearings. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2077 regarding tax credits for long-term rural enterprise zones. And Mr. Crawford, could you please orient us to the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2077 extends the sunset of the long-term rural enterprise zone property tax exemption from June 30th of 2018 to June 30th of 2024.
So I'm not sure if we have a proponent in the room on the bill. We don't have anyone signed up as a proponent. Do we have an individual member who is here as a proponent? Okay. Well, then with that, Ms. Weiser, welcome to the front. I am assuming that Ms. Weiser is not the bill proponent, but we can see. Welcome.
For the record, Jody Weiser for Tax Fairness Oregon. So this is the second hearing this year for this concept of continuing a tax break that we have. And at the last meeting, no business that receives the tax break showed up. Two economic development officers did, and they supported the bill. It's a curious tax break because it's one that we are not allowed, and neither are you, to know who the recipients are that have gotten it. The governor gives the tax break if he or she thinks it's a good idea, and it's gone to four or fewer tax recipients, businesses so far. I'm going to guess that it may have gone to some data centers, but that's a guess. We don't know. Basically, what it does is it says that if you're in a rural area and you're getting 15 years of paying no property taxes, well, you will also get another break if you actually owe over $1 million of income taxes. The break is that we will pay, as a public, 62.5% of your salary. So in the example that Chris Allenack put in his tax expenditure report, he had a company that owed $2.5 million in taxes and a payroll of $900,000. So basically, we would give a tax credit against the income taxes owed by that company of $562,000. So we're not charging any property taxes, and we're not collecting a lot of the income taxes. And in addition to that, the income taxes that we do receive, we return 30% of them to the local jurisdictions to use. So they've given up the property taxes, and we're giving them some of the income taxes. We could easily be going in the hole with these businesses. And since they don't show up to say they need it, and since they actually don't seem to pay enough taxes, okay, income taxes, to get to use the tax credits very often, it's mostly a talking point, it seems. But since we don't know about it, we would recommend that you end this tax break and you don't send it over to the tax credits committee. You don't know enough to think that it's a good idea. But if you do think it should be continued, you should amend it, and the amendment should require anybody that receives the tax break disclose information about their business instead of it being a secret that they're getting it.
Excellent.
Thank you so much. This, as background for the committee, since there's no proponent here, I just want to note that the way we came to have this bill is that I think Representative Barnhart, who has a liberal policy in terms of the bills for which he will seek bill drafts, as committee bills, the House Revenue Committee originated this bill, and my understanding is the bill, the tax credit at issue, would not actually sunset, please correct me if I'm wrong, until June 2018. So in the absence of a proponent here at our public hearing and absence a need to actually extend it this legislative session, because there will be an opportunity to consider it at the next legislative session, we thank you, Ms. Weiser, for being here, and we'll, and unless anyone, does anyone have any questions or comments about this bill, which has no proponent? I think Ms. Weiser would be happy to answer your questions.
I believe this is actually in its normal cycle for sunset review.
Okay. Did we?
There's a bunch of tax credits that are on a cycle for being reviewed, and this one's in its normal cycle.
So. So it could well be, but nonetheless, it stays alive through June 30th of 2018.
Right.
You know, absent action from this, from the legislature this session. So,
right.
Any follow-up questions? Potentially, we could have more conversation about it, but I think for right now, we'll close the public hearing on 2077. Thank you, Ms. Weiser, for your comments. We have one last bill for which another bill coming to us from the House Revenue Committee, somewhat similar posture, House Bill 2078, regarding university research and development. Mr. Crawford.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2078 extends the sunset of qualified research tax credits from January 1st, 2018 to January 1st, 2024.
Do Do we have any proponents on the committee of this bill? I believe it's a revenue committee bill that came to us. All right. And with no proponents signed up, I will call forward John Calhoun and Jody Weiser, who are signed up as opposed, to offer your thoughts.
Can I ask a quick clarification question?
Yes, please, Representative Post.
Madam Chair, thank you. So both of these have a subsequent referral, these two bills we've been talking about, have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits.
Right.
That's still kind of new to me because I don't think we ever had that.
I think this is a new, I think it's a new procedural posture starting this session where we are asked to do kind of a merits assessment of bills for which we're sort of simply an evaluator but not an ultimate decision maker in terms of whether they get funded or not. And then if we were interested in endorsing them essentially and referring them forward to Joint Committee on Tax Credits, they would make a decision substantively on whether there's essentially a budget to include the fiscal cost, revenue cost? The revenue expenditure of having the sunset lifted and the bill continued. This bill, and before I ask you to jump in, Ms. Weiser and Mr. Calhoun, this bill actually has a sunset that is January 2018. So okay. With the R&D bill, if we take no action and do not refer it even without endorsement to JTAX, then it will the sunset will occur before the end of the before the next opportunity in the next legislative session. So it's slightly different in a actually somewhat important way. So maybe we'll have more conversation or people can think about whether there is someone who wants to be a proponent of this bill in the future. But for now, we have Mr. Calhoun and Ms. Weiser. Welcome.
Thank you. So if you have my written testimony, I actually made a mistake, and it's marked, the bill is marked 2077, but it's 2078. Let the R&D tax credit sunset. So this is a less complicated bill, and probably the most valuable thing I can say is that there was an effort in 2015 to raise the amount of the tax credit for each business from $1 million tax credit to a $2 million tax credit. So there was a hearing about the research and development tax credit at that time. And the bottom of the page, you'll see that Vince asked, why does this R&D tax credit make your presence here more productive than it would otherwise be here in the state of Oregon? And I need specifics because we've got to measure back why we're doing this. After a pregnant pause, Mark Modjeski, the tax director for Tektronix, replied, I think that it's that's a tough question. In all honesty, I mean, would Tektronix be doing anything different if its business did not have this credit on the books? I would say no. I'll be on the record saying that. So since that point in time, there haven't been advocates for this tax credit in the room usually. It was a pretty strong statement. We wouldn't be doing anything different. I was once having lunch with a business owner who developed software. And in the course of the conversation, it came up that he and his partner had paid no income taxes that year. And the reason they had paid no income taxes is because a business had come to them, a CPA firm, and said, do you apply for the research and development tax credit? He said, no. And they said, we'll go through your books, we'll figure it out, we'll apply for you, and we'll take a cut of what we save you in taxes. So they reapplied, you know, did amended returns for prior years, and they ended up owing no taxes on research that had long been completed. Obviously, the tax break did not incent the research his business was doing. It was just a come along after the fact. His business continued. And so that's what we see. We're tied to a federal law. The federal government gives a tax break for research and development. And Oregon, like a number of other states, pays a percentage of the tax break. We add to the federal one. And there doesn't seem to be any particular reason to continue using it. According to the Chris Allenack's report, 385 businesses were eligible, and none of them is here saying, I need this.
Thank you so much. I do want to note that there are a number of letters in support of the bill actually on OLIS. So the Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce, the AOI, Oregon Bioscience Association, Beaverton Chamber of Commerce, Oregon Economic Development Association are some of those. So while it's certainly the case that they haven't signed up today, I was not accurate that they haven't made an affirmative expression of support for the bill. But thank you so much. Mr. Calhoun?
Yes. Chair Leininger, Vice Chair Marsh, and Vice Chair Smith, and members of the committee. My name is John Calhoun. I'm a resident of Portland. I'm here today speaking against HB 2078. I'm representing the Oregon Center for Christian Voices. I recently retired from a career in the tech industry. I started with Intel in 1972 when it was a small company. Over the next decade, the semiconductor industry was targeted by Japan, and Intel was eventually forced out of the memory chip business. One of the tools that Japan used to give it a competitive edge was subsidized low-cost capital, enabling Japanese semiconductor companies to build expensive wafer fabrication plants at a lower cost than American companies. The Semiconductor Industry Association argued for the creation of the federal R&D tax credit that was passed in 1981 as a means to counter the Japanese advantage. I know this because I was Intel's representative on the policy committee for the SIA, and we lobbied for the tax credit. In 1983 and 1984, I served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science and Electronics in the International Trade Administration at the U.S. Department of Commerce. By the way, that was the longest business title I've ever had. And I continued to lobby within the government for continuation of the federal R&D tax credit as part of the American trade policy. A lot has happened since then. Companies like Intel, Apple, and Microsoft now earn billions in profits every year and are not short of capital. While much of the R&D done by U.S. high-tech companies remains here in the U.S., much of the manufacturing is now based in other countries. Plants that used to cost tens or hundreds of millions of dollars cost billions. The R&D tax credit is simply no longer a factor in providing the necessary capital for the industry or keeping industry employment in the U.S. The Oregon R&D tax credit is even more ridiculous. The total tax credit benefit offered by the state is only $15 to $18 million per year, with half of the firms getting less than $25,000, while the industry spends $6 billion per year on R&D in Oregon. Do you honestly think that a credit of less than 0.3% changes any behavior? The Oregon tax credit accomplishes nothing. After I left Intel in 91, I spent the next 25 years working in startup companies and other tech sectors like software and medical devices. For true startups, the tax credit is not helpful because most of the businesses lose money during the product development stage of the business and therefore pay no income taxes. Once they become profitable, the tax credit is not a factor in their business planning. As Jody just mentioned, the application for the tax credit is usually driven by the accountants, not by the CEO or the head of R&D. In no company where I was a CFO or investor did the Oregon R&D tax credit factor into any management decision on R&D, nor did it provide any meaningful funds to assist the business. Frankly, the Oregon R&D tax credit is the purest example there is of a tax expenditure which is a total waste of resources and which provides no quantifiable benefit to the state. A similar expenditure at one of our state research universities would provide more benefit to the state and, frankly, to the industry. Those who tell you otherwise are simply going through the motions of protecting an unnecessary subsidy. If you're a tax manager at a high-tech company, it is worth writing a letter saying, yeah, keep sending us checks. At a time when we are facing a $1.6 billion deficit and are going to have to make many painful cuts, this should be one of your easiest decisions. Do not renew this tax expenditure. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks very much. Do we have any questions for Representative Post?
I don't have a question. I have a general question, yes. Perhaps yes. Council can answer. I've been told just now that this is where these committee bills get confusing. You cannot, correct me if I'm wrong here, sponsor, chief sponsor, co-sponsor a committee bill now that it's a committee bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Post, that's correct. That once a committee bill has otherwise been offered by a committee, then it is a committee bill forevermore.
Okay, so that's new to me. So that's why, back to your point on the last one, even if somebody wanted this to move forward from this committee to go to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, we'd have to do it as a this committee then, right? It wouldn't be by an individual in this committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Post, while it's true that an additional member cannot be added as a chief sponsor or a co-sponsor, an individual member can step forward to support a bill that is otherwise brought forward by a committee bill.
Define support.
For example, Madam Chair, Representative Post, Representative Smith spoke in favor of some long-term rural facility exemptions last week. So if Representative Smith wanted to come forward and support 2078 with testimony or any other.
Okay. So we could champion the bill. One of the issues that was confusing at the beginning was that there wasn't a member champion in the room for the bill, but even though it's a committee bill from a different committee, it could have a member champion from our committee or anywhere else. And it does have, and the Coalition for Smart Growth also has a letter of support. So there are probably about 6 letters in support from a range of business groups. And you know, we don't have to close the door permanently on the bill because this is not a robust meeting of members urging the extension of the sunset. Yeah. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will potentially sound really ignorant to everybody else, but I have a general question about tax credits that I'm hoping, while I've got them here, it applies to this. But so these are businesses that are making expenses. They already can write those off on their taxes as a deduction.
Correct.
So I just, in general, I'm not sure I totally understand what the purpose of a tax credit is compared to the fact that they can already write it off on a deduction, unless it's that they already had deducted all their income, so they were getting a refundable tax credit. But I see from your testimony that this one doesn't appear to even serve that purpose because it's not refundable. So why would you need a tax credit instead of just take it as a deduction?
That's true of pretty much all of our tax credits.
I know, that's why I sound feel stupid asking it, but yeah. I don't really know that I understand it.
So if you're a company that has a bunch of scientists working on developing a new paint color or a new software thing or a new dental product or whatever, you do get to deduct all the expenses of that work. The way the research and development tax credit works, there's some kind of floor. There's a floor of, in this year, you were spending this much on research and development. And the tax credit at the federal and state level is on the additional expenses above that floor that you spend. So I don't even know what the federal one is. I think it's 25%. It's really a way of delivering tax money back to you so next year you might invest more in research and development. And I mean, John spoke to the original purpose of giving the semiconductor industry a level playing field with Japan, but that was 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago.
I'm still not grasping. Like, if I had $100,000 in income and I had $100,000 in R&D expenses, I would write that all off and pay no taxes anyway. What does this do in that example? If this existed, what's the difference between this? Meaning, Chair, if you get rid of this, can't they still write it all off anyway?
Chair Loninger, Representative Clem, yes. It is an expense. It is deducted from your profits, but this is an additional tax credit on top of that.
So it's sort of doubling the tax value of making these activities.
Doubling isn't quite correct because as Jody mentioned, it's based on incremental expenditures and so on. It's a complex
calculation. I'm glad I'm not on the revenue committee. Holy cow.
It's a complex calculation, but the net effect is it's in addition to your normal
more than just deduction. The expenses that you're making. You're getting value. Okay, got it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So seeing no other questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2078. And with no other business before the committee, we'll adjourn early today. Thank you. All right. There you go. All right. There you go.